Hello everyone, and welcome back to the History of Scotland, episode 16, Dark Ages Myth versus Reality. So I know it's been a couple of weeks since our last episode. As I mentioned in the previous episode, episode 15, I've attended a wedding. It was at Allerton Castle, out of all places. It was a huge-ass place, full of history. So it was quite a fitting venue to go to. It was kind of compared to a real wedding. I was a groomsman there for my best mate. And honestly, if I could share you a lot of pictures, I would. But this is a audio platform recording software, not video recording platform. But honestly, yeah, it was such a great time. So I do apologise for the delay in episodes. But we are back on track now. We're starting on episode 16 with the Dark Ages, Myth vs Reality. And then after that, we can carry on with our normal schedule of the history of Scotland. But before we begin this week's episode, I just wanted to answer a question that was emailed to me again from Linda, a separate viewer of the show. A massive history nut, Linda has been sending me some pointers on how to structure the episode better and allow me to come out of my shell a little bit more. So thank you for your advice. But she has also asked an interesting question, which actually relates to this week's episode. But before that, if any of you guys have a question that you want answering, please email historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com, and I can answer them questions in the following episode. So anyway, back to Linda's question. She has asked, Scotland throughout the Dark Ages certainly progressed slow, but then began to rapidly expand and progress fast. Why is this? Very interesting point and question. It's something we have seen in the past, hasn't it, throughout all of our episodes, how kind of it went very slowly to gain small land, and now suddenly the expansion has taken a massive step forward. We have obviously gone through a load of tribes of the north of the wall to a now massive Scoto-Pictish nation that is ruled by many different ethnicities, but obviously one dynasty. Certainly this answer is one that we can answer with a bit of hindsight, but to the people back in the 900s AD, I doubt they ever thought of it like this. I doubt they ever looked back, oh well, we've progressed fast recently. I just think it was something that they expected to happen eventually. I think, though, if we get back to the question, the main contributors to the fast progress in Scotland / the Kingdom of Albert over the Dark Ages are the following. The Pictish and Dalriadic kingdoms, for one, combining into one main kingdom. This was an important event that cannot be underestimated. I would actually compare this to what England did with Mercia and Wessex when Edward the Elder, after his sister, the Lady of Mercia, died, brought the Mercian kingdom into Wessex and got rid of the Mercian kingdom title as a whole. And I would compare this again with the Pictish and Dalriadic merge. It was such a big event. There was a massive land consolidation and one ruling class of family. The invasion of the Vikings also changed a lot of England, but if anything, it managed to unite the people against a common foe. We see that across the continent. Christianity is obviously a common answer here. As a religion became the norm in Scotland, I think people grew to appreciate the need for a greater national identity. And then finally, the neighbours that surround Scotland itself and how they were progressing. With the Anglo-Saxon kingdom becoming the Kingdom of England, Welsh kingdoms growing stronger, Irish kingdoms growing stronger, and obviously before the England and Anglo-Saxons conquer it, the Viking Danelaw, Scotland needed to evolve if they wanted to survive. So the fast land progress we see in the later years can definitely be attributed to that as well. Anyway, hope that answers your question, Linda, in the best way possible. Thank you for your advice on the episodes, and I'm glad you're enjoying the series. Again, please, if you have any question that you want answering, please email historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com, and I can answer it in the following episode. Last week, though, we closed the book on the Picts, Dalriadics, and the Alapinid dynasty. This was a dynasty that had reigned over Scotland for a considerable amount of time. But more importantly, as I said last week, this was now, in my firm opinion, the end of the Dark Ages and the beginning of the Middle Ages we know in Scottish history. The identities of both Pictish and Dalriadic ethnicities will carry on throughout the following years. Heck, Gaelic as a language will survive for hundreds of years all the way to the modern day. But both the national identity of the Picts will be eventually replaced with a new identity. This being the identity of Scotland and the Scots. Something we can safely say has survived to the modern day. So I thought in today's episode it'd be good if we run through a general myth-busting exercise of what the Dark Ages can be defined as and what the myths that are being told are actually incorrect. As we know, A lot of modern history likes to point to the Dark Ages about being a dark and horrible time, where literacy goes to die. Yes, these times can be considered horrible by modern day standards, but that is, was it really a time of no learning, no literacy? Let's find out together with some interesting lists and points I've researched and gathered from my many different sources. Without further ado, let's jump into this. So, point number one. The idea of the Dark Ages came from later scholars who were heavily biased towards ancient Rome. In the years following 476 AD, various Germanic peoples conquered the former Roman Empire in the West, including Europe and North Africa, as we know, shoving aside ancient Roman traditions in favour of their own. The negative view of the so-called Dark Ages became popular largely because most of the written records of the time, including St. Jerome and St. Patrick in the 5th century, Gregory of Tours in the 6th century, and Bede in the 8th, had a strong Roman-centric bias. While it's true that such innovations as Roman concrete were lost and the literacy rate was not as high in the early Middle Ages as it was in ancient Rome, the idea of the so-called Dark Ages came from the Renaissance scholars like Petrarch, who viewed ancient Greece and Rome as the pinnacle of human achievement. Accordingly, they dismissed the era that followed as a dark and chaotic time, in which no great leaders emerged, no scientific accomplishments were made, and no great art was produced. All that can be considered largely false. We've already seen some great works of art, great leaders rise. So again, none of that, in my opinion, is true. Moving to point number two. The church replaced the Roman Empire as the most powerful force in Europe, redefining the relationship between church and state. In Rome's absence, Europe in the early Middle Ages lacked a large kingdom or other political structure as a single centralizing force. Apart from a brief period during the reign of the Frankish Emperor Charlemagne, instead, the medieval church grew into the most powerful institution in Europe, thanks in no small part to the rise of monasticism, a movement that began in the 3rd century with St. Antony of Egypt, and would rise to its most influential point in the High Middle Ages. Kings, queens, and other rulers during the early medieval period drew much of their authority and power from their relationship with the church. The rise of a strong papacy, beginning with Gregory the Great, the Pope who reigned from 590 to 604, meant the European monarchs could not monopolize power, unlike the days of the Roman Empire. The idea of limits on royal power would continue into the High Middle Ages, influencing such milestones as the Magna Carta and the birth of the English Parliament. Point number three. The growth of monasticism had important implications for the later Western values and attributes. The dominance of the church during the early Middle Ages was a major reason later scholars, specifically those of Protestant Reformation in the 16th century and the Enlightenment in the 17th and 8th centuries, branded the period as unenlightened, otherwise known as dark, where Dark Ages come from. Believing the clergy repressed intellectual progress in favour of religious piety. But early Christian monasteries encouraged literacy and learning, and many medieval monks were both patrons of the arts and artists themselves. One particularly influential monk of the early Middle Ages was Benedict of Nyssa, who was around 480 to 543 AD, who founded the great monastery of Monte Cassino. His Benedict rule, a kind of written constitution laying out standards for the monastery and congregation, and limited the abbot's authority according to these standards, spread across Europe, eventually becoming the model for most Western monasteries. Finally, Benedict's insistence that idleness is the enemy of the soul, and his rule that monks should do manual as well as intellectual and spiritual labour, anticipated the famous Protestant work ethic by the centuries coming. 4. The early Middle Ages were boom times for agriculture. Before the early Middle Ages, Europe's agriculture prosperity was largely limited to the south, where the sandy, dry and loose soil was well suited to the earliest functioning plough, known as the scratch plough. But the invention of a heavy plough, which could turn over the much more fertile clay soil deep in the earth, would galvanise the agriculture of northern Europe by the 10th century. Another key innovation of the period was a horse collar, which was placed around a horse's necks and shoulders to distribute the weight and protect the animal when pulling a wagon or plough. Horses proved to be much more powerful and effective than oxen, and the horse collar would revolutionise both agriculture and transportation. The use of metal horseshoes had become common practice by 1000 AD as well. Scientists also believe something called the medieval warm period, which took place from 900 to 1300, during which the world experienced relatively warm conditions. This held particularly true for the Northern Hemisphere, extending from Greenland eastward through Europe. Combined with the key advances in farming technology, uncommonly good weather appears to have fueled the agriculture boom of the period. 5. Great advances were made in science and math in the Islamic world. Among the more popular myths about the Dark Ages is the idea that the medieval Christian church suppressed the natural scientists, prohibiting procedures such as autopsies, dissections, and basically halting all scientific progress. Historical evidence doesn't support this idea. Progress may have been slower in Western Europe during the early Middle Ages, but it was steady, and it laid the foundations for future advances in the later medieval period. At the same time, the Islamic world leaped ahead in mathematics and sciences, building on the foundation of Greek and other ancient texts translated into Arabic. The Latin translation of the Commodus Book of Calculation by Completion and Balancing by the 9th century Persian astronomer and mathematician Al-Khazan would introduce Europe to algebra, including the first systematic solution of linear and quadratic equations. Point number 6. The Carolingian Renaissance saw a flowering in the arts, literature, agriculture, architecture, and other cultural realms. Carl, a son of Pepin the Short, inherited the Frankish kingdom with his brother Carloman when Pepin died in 768 AD. Carloman died several years later, and 29-year-old Carl assumed complete control, beginning his historic reign as Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, as we covered in a previous episode. Over some 50 military campaigns, his forces fought Muslims in Spain, Bavarians and Saxons in northern Germany, and Lombards in Italy, expanding the Frankish Empire exponentially. As representative of the first Germanic tribe to practice Catholicism, Charlemagne took seriously his duty to spread the faith. In 800 AD, Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne Emperor of the Romans, which eventually evolved into the title of the Holy Roman Emperor. Charlemagne worked to uphold this lofty distinction, building a strong centralized state, fostering a rebirth of Roman-style agriculture, architecture, and educational reform, and ensuring the preservation of classic Latin texts. A key advancement of Charlemagne's rule was the introduction of a standard handwritten script known as the Carolingian minuscule. With innovations like punctuation, cases, and spaces between words, it revolutionized reading and writing and facilitated the production of books and other documents. Though the Carolingian dynasty had dissolved by the end of the 9th century, his legacy would provide the foundations, including books, schools, curricula, and teaching techniques for the Renaissance and other later cultural revivals. Point number 7. That medieval people thought the earth was flat. Very controversial one if you're a flat earth believer. Virtually every medieval scholar believed the world was round. However, in the 19th century, it was widely reported that people in the Middle Ages thought the earth was flat because it made for a good example of how backward the period was believed to be. Number 8. That Primae Noctis actually happened. In 19th century France, it became popular belief that lords had several long-standing rights over their peasants, including the right to sleep with any bride the first night after her wedding. There are no recorded instances of this happening in the early Middle Ages or the later Middle Ages. Point number 9, that Vikings wore horned helmets. Vikings and other medieval warriors never wore horned helmets. They would not be very useful in battle. In the 19th century, Scandinavian artists began adding the imagery to their depictions of the Vikings, and that's where it came from. Number 10, that there were elaborate torture devices in the early Middle Ages or Dark Ages. There are many different gruesome torture devices, for example, the Iron Maiden, the Pear of Anguish, and the Breast Ripper. However, while many are said to be medieval torture devices, they were actually invented centuries later. Number 11. That medieval thinkers argued over how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. In more modern times, scholars who ridiculed medieval theology would say that they argued over silly notions such as how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. However, there is no example of a medieval scholar actually writing about this subject. Number 12, that chastity belts were used to prevent women from having sex. The story goes that when medieval lords went on crusade in the later period, or in the Dark Ages when they went to battle, they would make sure their wives would not have sex by enclosing their waist in a locked belt. The truth is that chastity belts were never used in the early Middle Ages or the late medieval ages, and they first became popular actually in the 19th century as part of that period's fascination with instruments of torture from the medieval times. Number 13, that early medieval people drank wine and beer because water was so polluted, and we see that throughout the entire Middle Ages, this reference. While people would avoid polluted water in these times, there were many sources of clean water which would be used for drinking. It was also common for water to be added to wine in order to make it less potent. Number 14, that the idea of a national identity didn't happen until the late medieval age. This one is a very easy kind of slam dunk no, just because we've already seen, at least in Scotland's history, that a national identity is something that the people took very seriously, and it started to develop very much so around the 700s AD. Point number 15, that people thought tomatoes were poisonous. Tomatoes were not even around in Europe during any part in the Middle Ages. The food was actually imported from South America in the 16th century and soon became widely used in most of Europe. Point number 16, that people did not live past 30 years old in the Dark Ages. It has long been stated that the life expectancy for a person in the Dark Ages or the medieval times was about 30 years old. This does not mean that a person was considered old or about to die when they turned 30. If a person around this time survived to adulthood, he would likely live in his 60s or 70s, and they would not be considered to be old until at least the age of 50. Life expectancy rates were lower in the Middle Ages because there was a much greater chance an infant or child would die because of illness or disease than in modern times. Point number 17. Dark Ages people did not use cutlery. Many people did not have to eat everything with their hands. Knives and spoons were common throughout the times, and the fork was introduced to the Byzantine Empire by the 6th century and into Italy by the 11th century. Point number 18, that Dark Ages people never travelled. The idea that medieval people would be born, grown up and die without ever travelling, leaving the village is very unlikely. Many different records show that people were travelling around and even moving to different parts of the country. Even peasants would go on pilgrimages that we saw Malcolm take in the later past episode and visit churches and monasteries in their country and overseas. So people did go around. They did move house, they did travel the country and they did go on pilgrimages. This is obviously due to Christianity. Point number 19, that the Dark Ages were always dirty and had a terrible personal hygiene. People in these times did take baths and would also try to keep clean. Combs and other personal grooming devices were also widely used, and we find this in the remains of a lot of Viking settlements as well. So the idea that Vikings didn't care about themselves is also false. Point number 20, that women in both the Dark Ages and medieval times had no rights. Women in the Middle Ages could inherit, buy and sell property, run a business and had many legal rights. In fact, some of these rights would diminish in the early modern period. The idea that they were virtually slaves to their husbands is also false. Not to say there weren't any horrible things that also happened. And our final point that I want to make was that all people were extremely pious and obeyed the church. While many people in this time were pious and extremely devout, we can find that church officials were often complaining that many other people were indifferent to following the religious practices. We can also find that even peasants had their own ideas about religion, which diverged from official church teachings, and that among theologians there were a lot of debate over many issues. And we all know what happened in the Great Schism. So in conclusion, let's round these points up. The past isn't dead, it isn't even the past. So goes the famous William Faulkner quote. This is very true, but I would add the past is a PR battle. History is not an exact science, and historians have their biases and agendas. And how we understand history, in turn, influences the choices we make today and tomorrow. Today, we are told a very simple story about the grand sweep of European history. It goes something like this. There was once the Roman Empire, technologically advanced and sophisticated. After the Roman Empire fell, Europe fell into a millennium of darkness, poverty, and religious superstition. Then came the Renaissance, when the West recovered the glories of the Greco-Roman thought about science, and the wheel of progress started to turn again, leading to the Enlightenment, when philosophers threw off the fetters of irrational religion to advocate for free inquiry, human rights, and so on. Historians typically pick 475 AD, the formal end of the Western Roman Empire, as a start date for the Dark Ages, recognising that it's an arbitrary pick since the disintegration of the Roman Empire happened gradually over centuries. For the other bookended, they typically either pick 1453, the fall of the Eastern Roman Empire, or 1492, the arrival of Christopher Columbus in America. But I'd like to make a modest proposal. Let's retire the phrase Dark Ages. It's not just misleading and ideologically biased, it's also on its own terms entirely meaningless. We can do better. The very expression Dark Ages speaks of an era in between, when essentially nothing interesting happened. But the Dark Ages and the Middle Ages was actually an enormously monotonous and an innovative era. Early medieval innovations in agriculture, such as the iron plough, water and wind milling, and the free field system enabled Europe to break out of the Malthusian trap that Rome had become stuck in for centuries, empowering it to withstand innovations that had felled its supposedly advanced predecessors. Everything was commonly associated with the Renaissance and the early modern era, such as international trade and its handmade of capitalistic finance, scientific tinkering, classical culture, and philosophical inquiry, was in fact already present in the Middle Ages. As an alternative, I propose that we say that after antiquity begins Christendom, or the Christian period. For more than 1,000 years across what we now call the West, Christianity was recognised and largely accepted, if only in theory or in the word in many cases, as the dominant organising principle of metaphysical, political, social and moral reality. As such, our start date for this era has to be 380 AD. The date of the Edict of Thessalonica, where Emperor Theodosius made Nicene Christianity the state church and the only officially recognised religion of the Roman Empire. It is not generic Christianity that becomes dominant in this era, but Orthodox Christianity of the apostate Christian church, an organised entity. This does not change with the 1054 schism between the Western and Eastern churches, since that schism was seen by almost all participants except the most radical as a split within the legitimate Christian church. Mark Weber famously said that the state is the holder of the monopoly of legitimate violence. But what defines Christendom is that for the first and thus far last time in the history of the West, the apostolic Christian church had, if not a monopoly on violence, which it never sought, but a monopoly on legitimacy itself. That monopoly was always exploited for the base purposes, but in the world view of everyone, it was agreed upon that Christianity was the centering of legitimacy, no matter how often it may have been abused. Some may say the start date for Christendom has to be the fall of the Western Roman Empire, since it did indeed profoundly alter the landscape politically and economically in Western Europe. But this is a fanatic. After all, if you look at the events of those centuries from Constantinople, not from Western Europe, what you see is a gradual loss of territory to the Roman Empire that went on to exist for a millennium after the fall of the last Western Roman Emperor. Events, to be sure, but not the end of an era. And with the stunning speed the barbarian kings and soon the new Roman emperors, who would replace the Western Roman Empire, fell into Christendom, indeed they often accepted the leadership, if only symbolically, of the Eastern emperors, recognising that the Roman Empire was still a reality, even if it was only a formal one, in the hopes of the Holy Roman Empire. So, when does Christendom end? I would argue for 1555. This is the date of the Peace of Augsburg, which sought to end the wars between Protestantism and Catholicism in Germany by establishing a legal principle known as the Cursus Regio, which stated that the religion of the ruler of a realm was to dictate the religious practices of those who ruled. This decisively flips the theoretical order of precedence between religion and politics. While politic rulers had always manipulated religion for their own ends, it was always proclaimed and accepted that religion was the overarching criticism or the control. But from this point on, religion is determined by the rulers and not the other way round. What is more is the decentralized nature of the new Protestantism religion meant that no single church could function as an institutional anchor for the West in the way that the Catholic Church had done for over a millennium. All over Europe, rulers flocked to Protestantism, which has no instinctual doctrinal content since it's based on anyone's personal interpretation of the Bible as a tool to legitimize their actions, making the sort of Christendom that had existed before impossible. To a lesser extent, this was also the case in Catholic lands, since to ward off kings just doing that, the Pope handed a significant measure of control over to the clergy, to many kings, turning bishops and abbots into public servants. What should we call the era that opens from 1555 and extends into today? Modernity is just as meaningless as Middle Ages. Instead, I propose that we call the era in which we currently live the era of the state. The state is what joins together the regimes that appear in the West from the 16th century onwards. Whether absolute monarchies, liberal democracies, or totalitarian dictatorships, all these regimes have a secular government, not the Christian Church as a local of legitimacy that is universally accepted as such and brooks no rivals. This is what joins together Marx, Mussolini, Thomas Jefferson, Napoleon and Barack Obama. Obviously from the 16th century onwards, Christianity remains a powerful shaping force, but it is no longer the apex of legitimacy. Yes, the Dark Ages were in some sense a reality, but they were a reality not because they happened to sit between antiquity and our supposedly enlightened recent past, but because they were profoundly shaped by a unique worldview, one that was succeeded by an equally monumentous yet markedly different worldview. Now, as Pascal Emmanuel Gobry, whose work helped with this episode, says, go update those textbooks with everything we have learned today. Well, let's finally say goodbye to the Dark Ages. It's been great to be in an era so nasty and horrible, full of nothing but hate, right? No, obviously this is a joke, but honestly, the Dark Ages has taught me so much about history and about one empire collapsing across Europe, changing the outcome for all European countries we see today. Truly one of the most important and interesting times in history. As I mentioned, next week we'll be starting with the famous House of Dunkeld and Duncan the First, and obviously Macbeth after that. So stand ready and get ready for a whopper of a tale that has stood the test of time. Again, thank you to Linda for asking that question earlier in the episode, and thank you to everyone for the continued support on this series. It's great to see so much interest in Scottish history from around the world. As always, any corrections or issues with the podcast, please let me know at historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. That is historyofscotlandpodcast@gmail.com. Please also leave a review if you can, and our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, and many other great podcasting sites. Next week, our podcast will be on as normal, and we'll continue our story. So until then, stay safe, have a great week, guys, and I'll catch you on the next one. Peace.